Far away from his native Guatemala, novelist Arturo Arias monitors human rights violations against writers there. For the past 10 years, Arias has lived outside Guatemala, mainly in the U.S., but he serves as president of the Guatemalan chapter of PEN, the International Writers Union. It's a paradox, but most of the writers in the Guatemalan chapter are living in exile. They've also had a hard time getting their work published in Guatemala. Arias' novel, After the Bombs, was first published in Mexico in 1979. An English translation has just been published in this country by Curbstone Press. Arias writes in the Latin American tradition using symbolism and fantasy to tell a story. After the Bombs opens with the bombing of Guatemala City in 1954, a real event that Arias lived through.
I was then 4 years old. We had a democratic government, the government of President Arbenz, which was accused by the Eisenhower administration of being a communist government because it had passed a land reform program, which ironically was modeled on the U.S. land reform programs in the Pacific Rim after World War II. And so the equivalent of a contra army, a mercenary army, was assembled in Honduras, which is borders Guatemala, and they invaded Guatemala in June of 54. And there was they were rebel planes which bombed Guatemala City mainly to scare the army into surrendering and to scare the civilian population. That they succeeded in doing very effectively, because among the scared civilians was my mother, who grabbed me, like I described in the beginning of the book, and threw herself under the desk as the planes dived and the bombs explode in the horizon. I was very young then, and it felt like, you know, like a World War II bombing, zillions of planes and bombings exploding all over. In fact, as an adult, when I've done research on it, there were only like two or three planes, and they threw only small bombs. But, you know, when you're under that, it felt like the whole world was falling apart. And so since the subjective, the emotional reaction was the initial one, that's the one I tried to capture in the book.
What was the political outcome of the bombing?
The political outcome was that the government resigned. The military came into power and stayed in power for 31 years. And Guatemala's atrocious record of human rights violations began, which made them world champion of human rights violations, the only thing Guatemala's ever been world champion at. So it was really the beginning of the end for Guatemala.
Your main character says at one point that their principal weapon is words. Do you believe that? Do you believe that that words are very effective in fighting against a government?
I would not claim that they are the only means of resisting a dictatorial government, but they are very effective, because part of the logic of a dictatorial regime is that it tries to create a false history, the official story, to use the well-known phrase from the title of that movie. And so the job of the writer, of the artist, is to name the truth, to name the reality, to name that the emperor has no clothes. And part of the capacity of survival of a dictatorship is the degree to which it can pretend to the outside world that it's business as usual, that it is normal what's going on there, and the degree to which it gets called and named that it is not. And that international pressure begins to build, it becomes always an element of threat for the survival of that given dictatorship. So it is that role which intellectuals and artists and writers play, and it is why, whereas on the one hand, one is very weak, one is very vulnerable, nonetheless, you have an enormous amount of power to shape things by naming things that, say, a first-world writer or artist doesn't.
When did you leave Guatemala? I know you've been, you studied in the States, you've been teaching in the States. How old were you when you actually left there?
Well, I had left Guatemala many times, but originally I left when I was 19 and I got a scholarship to Boston University. That was the first time I officially left. At Boston, I got both a BA and an MA. Then I went to Paris and got a PhD in France. And the idea was to start teaching at the University of San Carlos as of January of 1980, which I did begin to do. But it was in January of 1980 that things began getting really out of hand in Guatemala. And shortly after that, General Lucas, who ran the country, said on national TV that the University of San Carlos was the center of subversion in the country. And everybody who worked at the university, their names began to appear in death lists. An army jeep machine gunned students worked at a student bus stop in front of the campus. And so when Easter vacation came around, I went on vacation to Mexico and didn't come back.
And have you gone back since?
Yeah. I stayed away from Guatemala between 1980 and 1985. When Vinicio Cerezo became president in 1986, I began coming back to the country, and I've made a point of coming back at least once a year since then.
Is it frustrating to you that Americans seem to know a lot less about Guatemala than they do, say, about El Salvador or Nicaragua?
It is frustrating. I think that it is logical to the degree that there is more direct U.S. presence in both El Salvador and Nicaragua. What the Guatemalan army succeeded in doing was in becoming less dependent on direct U.S. military aid, and as a result, they became much less of an issue inside the U.S. and, you know, inside Congress. And therefore, they were able to implement the policies that they implemented with much less of a, you know, of a screening eye from the U.S. And I think that one of the elements that play out there is also a racist element. Most of the people who were killed in Guatemala in the 1980s were Indians, Mayan Indians. And Guatemala is itself a very racist country. It is almost, you know, like South Africa in a way, except without an institutional apartheid. But the separation between mestizos and Indians is just as dramatic. And so it was passed as if, well, you know, it's, there's nothing dramatic here because it's just Indians who are dying. So what's the big deal?
How did you start writing, and what kind of books did you have to read when you were growing up?
Well, I always wrote. Somehow, writing always attracted me. Not just writing, but storytelling. I began my first novel when I was 8, and of course I never finished it, and it wasn't any good either. But just to show that the interest was there. And my main interest was not just that I like to write, but that I like to tell stories. I saw myself as a storyteller, and I always loved to tell stories and to invent on reality. At the time, like most kids, I guess, my age, I was reading adventure novels. In Guatemala, we're speaking now middle 50s, among the authors that seemed to be very popular at the time, there was, of course, Jules Verne. There was Emilio Salgari, the Italian one who wrote about all those pirates and things. And so there was a sense of adventure and a sense of fantasy and of escape from the reality, which always seems so oppressive in Guatemala through literature. Now, when I was growing up, TV still didn't exist in Guatemala, so that literature was still the primary way of escaping reality, of visualizing alternative worlds, of flowing into an imaginary world. And therefore, the link between imagination and language took place very, very early and became a very dynamic process in my own life. I imagine that to some degree, with newer generations, this may be changing. Nonetheless, since Latin America still produces very little film and TV on its own, literature is still the primary space in which one confronts oneself, in which one confronts society, in which one tries to shape a national identity. Whereas in the first world in general, of course, cinema and TV have displaced literature in that function.
What about radio? I know radio has been very popular in Latin America, and certainly the soap operas.
Oh, yes. Radio soap operas were great, and I used to listen to them, too. Basically, what radio did for me was sharpen the ear for storytelling, for plot structures, and for popular usage of language, which has always fascinated me, too. Most of the soap operas dealt with lower middle-class people, at least the ones I heard. And so I was exposed to a different language, to a different Spanish than the one that my intellectual middle-class family normally employ on a daily basis. And therefore, the play with language was very, very important for me, and the sense of plot, the sense of dramatic tension. And the other voice that I think was important for me and was important for many writers Like any average middle-class family in Latin America, we had maids. And those maids were Indian, and they told us all kinds of wonderful stories about, you know, legends, ghost stories, all kinds of things. And that definitely was a very contributing factor to the shaping of my imagination. And I know that it was so of other writers who have lived in the same environment.
What language are you writing in now?
Spanish. I always write my fiction in Spanish. I have done academic writing in English. I'm a professor too. But when it comes to fiction writing, to novel, only Spanish, I don't think that I can ever, no matter how good my English ever gets, be able to have the subtlety and the inside knowledge of language that I do in Spanish.
And what language do you read in? Do you read in Spanish and English?
I read in Spanish, English, French, Portuguese, and a little bit of Italian.
Boy, I envy you knowing so many languages. Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us about your writing.
It was my pleasure.
And Arturo Arias has been my guest. His novel, After the Bombs, has just been published in English.